D from Las Vegas, Nevada.
I'm Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic. Sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained over the years through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. The ability to remain sponsorable and not self-directed, and a persistent and consistent effort in trying to forget myself and devote my life to my primary purpose of helping other drunks. And through all of that, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that is and remains the great miracle in my life. Delighted to be here. That was the absolute longest version of the set-aside prayer I have ever heard. I was actually there when the original, Don Pritz created the original, and it was just really simple. He was telling a sponsee, he was a little bit of a knucklehead, was an intellectual, just to say, listen, let's just ask God to set aside everything you think you know for a new experience. And it was simplistic, and I am surprised over the years how spirituality becomes more and more simplistic as the years go on. And I think God is very much like me. If my prayers are long and wordy, I don't want to bore him. So I just kind of keep it to the point and conversational. Isn't that odd that I would have that kind of relationship, that kind of an intimate relationship with a God that 41 and a half years ago I didn't believe in? I considered myself an atheist. And I'm supposed to talk on step three, and I got to tell you, truly, I want to tell you more about the things that I did wrong, more about my mistakes, more about misinformation that blocked me. And I think that's the most important thing we share with each other. It's not so much what we do right, because what we do right ends up like a sermon. It's what we do wrong that people identify with. And it's our struggles and our fears and our misconceptions. And I had a lot of misconceptions about the steps, and especially step three. You know, step three, as it says on the wall, in the 12 steps, as you'll see them on the wall, it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And, well, I got some problems with that. Basically, my two problems with that are step one and step two. Because when you don't really, in your innermost self, in the pit of your stomach, where that place where there's no debate, if you don't have step one and step two, step three, at best, will be intellectually placated. And at best, it will be like some of the ministers and clergy that I've sponsored over the years that you could have put them on a lie detector, and they would have told you how they've turned their will and their life over the care of God, and yet, if you watch their actions, not so much. You know, it says in the book, we stood at the turning point, and we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Complete, I'm not sure what complete means, but I think it's a lot. I think it's without reservation. I think it's complete. And how many of us can do that? And how many would even entertain to do that if I'm not beaten half to death by not by alcohol, but by my very, very best efforts of trying to manage my own life sober? With information, I became a, in the early 70s, I became a therapist, a counselor, because my ego has always believed that it will find power in knowledge. And in knowledge, I will elevate myself above the low IQ masses, right? And I'll just kind of be in intellectual superiority and power and all that stuff. And And all it ever was for me, all knowledge ever was fodder for my ego to puff me up and keep me more separate and more the guy living the double life. You know, the stage character, the guy I want you to think I am, and then secretly, no matter how much I fool you, I don't fool me. So I was actually a very good counselor right up to the day I got fired from the drug and alcohol clinic for being drunk on the job. They don't like those things there, those kind of behaviors. They have no sense of humor about that. And all my knowledge had done me no good at all. And I'm in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous over six, almost 7 years. And in those years, I lived the progression of the disease. I know what it's like to over any considerable time to get worse, never better. I get that. That is me. And you don't have to convince me of that. I lived that. I watched the progression of the disease. I watched the horrible deterioration of how I felt about myself, the horrible deterioration of my relationships with people, the horrible slipping into deeper levels of depression and anxiety. The more time went on, the harder it was to be sober in the presence of the guy I was beginning to loathe for what he did to people that he cared about. And I started to live that. And I went to a lot of therapists, some great ones. My mother was a therapist. Through her help and the help of my dad, who was a legendary environmentalist, I got to go see some of the greatest psychiatrists in the United States at the time, guys like Albert Ellis, who you couldn't even see Ellis unless you were a movie star or a senator or something. He was a big shot. He started Rational Emotive Therapy at two institutes, and I used to go up to New York City. And I was in therapy with Dr. Silverman, who had studied with Fritz Perls and Alan Watts. And I primal screened, and I did transactional analysis and gestalt therapy and on and on and on. Also the little stories into transcendental meditation and divine light mission and the Namne Yoho Renge Kyo with SGI, Buddhism, and on and on. Desperately reading books by Jay Krishnamurti and Alan Watts and anything I could do to fix me. And the harder and the more effort I used to fix me, the worse I got. It was baffling to me. Where I should have been getting better, I was getting worse. And I didn't understand the nature of this sickness that drives me. And I didn't even understand that I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. You know, I had a dozen reasons why my case was different. I'm sort of an alcoholic. I did a lot of drugs. I did heroin. I'm sort of an alcoholic, but I did and stimulants. I'm sort of an alcoholic, but I'm a depressive. I'm sort of an alcoholic, but I really have a terrible anxiety problem to the point where I feel like I'm having nervous breakdowns. I'm really an alcoholic, but I came from a good family. I had a childhood burden with love, which makes you feel bad about yourself if you're like me. I had all these things I could point at to keep me separate and apart from and different from the people in AA. And I was struggled. I couldn't get step one. I didn't want to get step one. Truly, I guess there was a part of me that still fancied that somehow, someday, some way, for God's sakes, I'm going to get that fun back. I'm going to capture that old party. I'm going to get that ease and comfort, and I'm going to reap the fun in a way that where I keep the damage down to something reasonable. And I kept taking runs at it, and I kept taking runs at it, and I kept getting spiraling down to lower and lower things. And I remember many, many times being in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and just coming off a run, and I've just burnt my life to the ground again. I'm in some Skid Row halfway house or some detox, and I'm at the meeting where all the do-gooders come in, you know, the AA meeting. And sometimes I'm desperate. There are times in those places where I'm so sick of me. I'm so sick of this whole thing because drinking's not even fun anymore. I can't get back to that good old days. I still hope that I can, but I can't. And so I listen to people in AA. And I remember one time I was in an institution up in Maine, and I was listening to a speaker who captivated me. I was really identifying with this guy. I mean, he was amazing. And he was a tough guy. He was an outlaw biker. I mean, he's the kind of guy I would have drank with. And I'm listening to him, and he talks about ending up in prison, where he was introduced to alcohol. He was made by his whoever was in charge go to an AA meeting. It was highly suggested. And he went to an AA meeting, and he started to talk to people there, and he got a sponsor. And then he said something that just knocked me out of the box. He said, and through AA, I found God. And I remember when he said that, just sitting there thinking, oh, no, what have they done to him? Oh, my God, he's cool. They've turned him into a sunbeam for Jesus. Oh, my God, this is embarrassing. And I remember thinking somewhere, God, I'd rather die than have that happen to me. And I almost did. And I almost did. You know, I fancied myself an atheist, but I'm not really an atheist, because I've known some atheists, and you have to be very religious about your atheism to be a good atheist. Well, I'm a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy at the core of who and what I am is a feeling and a sense that if there was a God, and I'm hoping there's not, but if there was a God, man, I am never going to be good enough for him. I'm just too bad at being good, and I'm too good at being bad, and I can be good for a little while, and then I kind of outgood myself, and I can't do it anymore. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but I just, you get me sober, and all kinds of bizarre things seem like a good idea. And I'm stained in a way that if there's a God, he's not gonna warm up to a guy like me. You don't know the weird feelings I have. You really, if you knew the things that I think. I remember sitting in an office, sitting there having somebody, an AA counselor kind of person, talking to me, and I just was on the sitting across this desk, and I just remember thinking, what would it be like to shove that pencil through his cheek? You know what I mean? No, I don't do it, but you can't tell anybody that. I mean, they'll lock you up. And I'm crazy, but I'm not so crazy as to not know what crazy is. But I keep it all secret. It's all more bricks in the wall between me and you, where I tell myself how different my case is. And when you guys talk about God, it just seems hopeless to me. I'm the guy by nature. If I just think you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. And I was that way with God. And I couldn't imagine that something that was so good and so powerful would ever have anything to do with something that was so weak and so bad, even though I didn't mean to be. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt them severely. And the ones I hurt the most were the ones that were the kindest and the most loving towards me. And I gutted my mother and father and many other people emotionally. Yeah, there's a God. He might be okay for you, people in AA, because I could tell you were kind of nice people. But you don't know about me. My case is different. But you drink enough whiskey, and I'll tell you something, and you let this disease progress, where abstinence is getting more painful, and you're suffering more sober, and you don't understand why, because you shouldn't be suffering sober, because it looks like alcohol, and drinking alcohol is my problem, and then I get sober, and I start to suffer. I don't understand that what I'm suffering from is alcoholism without the medicine of alcohol. But I suffer sober. And I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me because I should be better now that I'm not drinking. I should have been better now that I was in therapy. I should have been better. And all my should have beens end up being really, I'm worse. I keep getting worse. And so, you know, I suffer my way back into another drink again. Sometimes after only weeks, sometimes after many months, but it becomes inevitable that when I get physically sober, that my reaction to abstinence is so bizarre and so abnormal that it will suffer me back to picking up a drink eventually. And so in 1978, after relapsing for almost 7 years since I was a kid, I started coming to AA before I was old enough to take a legal drink. And I got to a place, our book says, a place where there's nothing left. And you don't even believe in God. You don't believe in AA. You don't believe in anything. But you believe in the hopelessness and futility of your life as you'd been living it. Believe it. I lived that. And if you have been trying, you've been trying to get sober and swearing to yourself for years, you'll never touch that stuff and meaning it and always going back to it. And it gets worse. It never gets better. And abstinence gets worse. It never gets better. And everything is just progressing and spiraling down into this abyss. And by 1978, I am at the end of my rope. My drinking is horrible. And it's not just that it's horrible. I've lost all hope of jump-starting that old party. I'd been chasing the ghosts of parties past for 2 or 3 years and failing over and over and over again. My drinking was miserable. I drank in depression, loneliness, pathetic feelings of self-loathing. I couldn't even drink away the remorse and shame anymore. All I had in the bottle was hope of oblivion and to blot me out. And if you're like that and drinking has become horrible, and then you get sober time and time again, and sober is not any good either. It feels like I'm doing time. And I'm literally in a trap I can't spring. And I'm stuck. And boy, I'll tell you, late-stage alcoholism, I've talked to hundreds of people, it kind of feels like you're stuck. You're stuck in a trap you can't get free of. And I didn't know what to do. And a doctor that previous year told me that I was a young kid in my 20s. He said, if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you, but you're a young kid. It might take 5 more years. And I came to in a level of despair that was in hopelessness, because there's no hope anywhere. There's no hope in the bag and the bottle. There's no hope in friend. There is no people left. When I was arrested the last time, when they gave me the phone call, there was nobody to call. My sponsor says you get to a place where there's no friendly direction. And I decided to kill myself. And I was actually felt better in the decision, and I through a series of circumstances, I failed. Because I'm a coward, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm just afraid that the method I'm going to try isn't going to work, and instead of dying, I'll end up paralyzed from the neck down in a freaking charity ward and lay there for 50 years sober as my head just revisits every little corner, squirmy place of shame and remorse and self-loathing over and over and over again. And I couldn't even kill myself. And there, that is a failure. It's like the icing on the feces cake. You know what I'm saying? It's a failure. I failed at everything else. Now I can't even kill myself. Oh my God, this is a level of pathetic beyond anything I've ever known. And through a bizarre series of circumstances, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know until I'd heard Chuck Chamberlain talk somewhere in late 78 at our intergroup meeting. And he said he'd been surrendered by the bottle. And I knew something had happened to me. And I knew something had happened to me because for the first time in 7 years, I had a home group. I had commitments. I had a sponsor. I was praying, even though I don't believe in God. I was taking actions I'd never taken before, and I wasn't sure how that happened. But something was different. And when I was only maybe a week or two or three, I don't know, not very long out of the detox, I went to a meeting at the Solano Club where it was one of the only AA clubs I felt comfortable at because it was a really low bottom. I mean, this is true, it was spiritually nestled between a bottomless, topless strip joint and a pawn shop. It was just something right about that place for a guy like me who's off the streets. And it was one of those places where you'd be in a meeting and somebody'd fall out of their chair and flop around like a fish out of water, frequently go into seizures in the meeting. But it was homey. You know what I mean? Now, those fancier meetings at the big churches and the fancy AA clubs, I'd go there and I'd feel like a whore church. I don't feel like I don't fit there. These people are too good for me. But at that Alano club, I felt like I belonged there. I was after a meeting one time, this guy Joe comes up to me after the meeting. Never forget this. What a turning point. And he says to me, he says, kid, you need to take step three. And I said to him, and I was really honest, I liked this guy Joe a lot. He was an interesting guy. And I said, Joe, I can't. And he said, why not? I said, well, Joe, I don't believe in God. He said, I thought you were praying. Yeah, my sponsor got me praying, but I don't believe in God. And he said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. And I argued with him a little bit. The steps were on the wall. I said, well, it looks like you have to. Came to believe in God as we understood him. He said, kid, you don't have to believe in God. He said, if you'll turn your will and your life over this chair, I guarantee you a miracle. I'm a wise guy, so I said, all right, what the hell? All right, Joe, I turn my will and my life over the chair. And Joe gets this big grin on his face. He says, kid, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't get defensive or mad or nothing. I just thought, oh, my God, that would be right. It's not so much that I got to find God or understand God. I got to get rid of me. And it made a funny kind of sense to me. It's not so much, I heard Sandy Beach when I was a few years sober. He was arguing with his sponsor about the third step, and because he wasn't sure if there was a God, he was just like me. And he said to his sponsor, he said, listen, I don't think I can, I don't have a God. And he said, listen, Sandy, you don't have to turn your will and your life over to God. For God's sake, just give it to whoever or whatever will take it, as long as it's not you. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I got to get my life out of the hands of the idiot. And all the selfishness, all the self-grandizement, the self-promotion, and all the wanting notoriety and property, money, prestige, all that crap comes from the selfishness of the idiot. The idiot that has such a huge vacancy inside. My ego is so empty and so vacant that it just thirsts for more of everything. It thirsts for more property, more money, more prestige, more attention, more gratification. Matter of fact, if you got what I got, instant gratification is not quick enough. I got the attention span of a gnat. I need relief, and I need it now. And that's what's killing me. My life is in the hands of that, and that's killing me. But I don't know it. The most devious thing that the ego does and that keeps me in this bondage of self is that it convinces me it doesn't exist. Or what it's so hideous, it talks to me in my voice, in my head, and it convinces me at times that it's me. It's not me. A guy in AA told me that. That's not you. No, he said, no, you're the idiot that listens to it. To get my life out of the hands of the idiot, the egocentric, needy, insatiable idiot that has almost destroyed me. And so I I think the real moment that occurred was when I was scared to death, and I was still in the detox, and I went up to the man who would be my first sponsor, and I asked him. I was shaking inside. I was so afraid of rejection, and I was risking myself here. And I asked him if he'd sponsor me, and I had to tell him that if you will, I'll do anything you ask me to do. What I really wanted to say, give me a chance. I won't be any trouble, really. Give me a chance. And he said yes, and the journey began. And I think that was the moment that I got my life out of the hands of an idiot. There's many, many people in Alcoholics Anonymous that their ego grows within their recovery. They want a sponsor because they need the bragging rights of having a sponsor, but they're unsponsorable. They're so obsessed with having their hands on the wheel of their ship, they will not let it go. You know, they have a sponsor who, you know, if they have a problem in their life, they don't call up and ask for direction. They call up after they get through the problem to tell their sponsor what they did just in case he ever needs that information, because they're givers. And that is the ego despising itself as a full-blown recovery. Did I step on a dog? I am so sorry. Let me kick it out of the way. Oh, they're good. Now the SPCA is going to hate me. I get it. All right. Anyway, so this process of coming to this decision is really based on innermost self realizations. And right after the ABCs, which I believe is the essence of step one and step two, A, that I am alcoholic, and that is a whole bunch right there. Not that I have a drinking problem, not that I shouldn't drink, or not that I got a DUI, that I am an alcoholic. Not that I have a drug problem, so it's all the same, no. That I am an alcoholic. And cannot manage my own life. And there's a period there. There's no caveat. There's not, I can't, my life is unmanageable because of my drinking. That my life is unmanageable. More unmanageable sober than it was when I was drinking. At least when I was drinking, I had the benefit of something to numb me out a little bit. At least when I was drinking, I had some anesthetic in my life. I had some escape in my life. But sober, man, my life is really unmanageable sober. And some of the descriptions of the unmanageable life, like Silkworth, his, you know, restless, irritable, discontent. And I know some of us get that way, but it's not our fault because we're surrounded by idiots. But if you're restless, irritable, and discontent, you are the source of the restlessness. You are the source of the discontent, and you're the source of the angst. And on page 52 is a description of me every time I get sober without a surrender and without a continual process of keeping me in the zip code of the surrender. I'm this guy. I can be this guy today with 41 years of sobriety. And it's only the actions I take that allow enough grace in my life to protect Bob from Bob, that I'm not entrenched in these symptoms every day. And it's the first symptom, it says, having trouble with personal relationships. Huh. Well, I don't know where you're all from, but that's a big one here. Why are we having problem with personal relationships? Well, it's hard to get them to mind. You know what I mean? It's hard to get them to see, to get on the right page about the right things. As it says in the fifth chapter, our little plans and designs. What gets in my way is my way. What gets in my way is having a way. And so I couldn't having trouble with personal relations. Couldn't control my emotional nature. Oh my God, I'm trying. I get most people acting pretty good, and there's always one of them that turns on me and ruins my day, sink me right into a depression. And I suffer from depression. I suffer from anxiety. I suffer from excitement, which is just as dangerous to me as depression and anxiety. You want to see me make some crazy decisions? Excite me. We were a prey to misery and depression. We live in a funny society. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, if you got sober and you were depressed, they would say things to you like, well, for God's sakes, you should be. Look at what you've done in your life. If you got sober and were not depressed, there'd be something wrong with you. Today, oh, you are? Here, we got some medication for you. I'm a prey to misery and depression. It's a symptom of alcoholism when I stopped drinking. I couldn't make a living. Well, I could get a job. It's just hard to stay there because I notice how stupid they are so quickly. I can't keep a job. I interview well. I can do very good in the beginning. I'm a 100-yard dasher. I'm the guy that 1 week they're saying, oh, my God, we're so glad Bob works here. And the next week they're wondering how they can get rid of me. Right? It's just because that's the guy I am. Had a feeling of uselessness my whole life. Like this feeling I have no purpose in my life. I don't know what my life's about. I don't know what I'm supposed to be when I grow up. I don't even know who I am. That's what I loved about the hippie movement. We were all obsessed with taking drugs and finding ourselves. I never found myself. I never knew who I was. You introduced me to me through your experience. As I sat in meetings over the years and listened to you, and I would sit there and go, oh my God, that's me. You introduced me to me in a way that some of the greatest psychiatrists could not do. A feeling of uselessness. We're full of fear. Oh my God. I used to get anxiety to the point of panic. I'm a funny guy. I can, whatever I look at, I don't see the good. I see the potential problems. My mind is a problem-seeking missile. It only looks for things I have to defend myself against. I've never sat down and checked my future and found potential joy. When I check my future, I see problems. I see, matter of fact, I can look at this screen right now and see problems. I don't see good members of AA. You know what I see? I see a few people I think are judging me. I see a few people that aren't even listening to me. I don't see good. I have a problem-seeking missile perception. And if you're like that, no wonder abstinence is so difficult. And so I have to get out of this. I have to get out of this trap I cannot spring. And you know, our book talks about the real root of this is selfish and self-centeredness. The problem is it doesn't look that way to me. I don't think I'm selfish. A selfish person cannot identify themselves as a selfish person because of all the rationalizations and justifications and explanations. The ego is the most defended mechanism in the universe. And so not only can I change myself, I can't even see myself. And I've sat hundreds of times in despair. You know, I'm a little sober and my life is crap and it seems hopeless and what's the point? And I'm probably not going to stay sober anyway. And just, it looks bad. And I feel better. Sometimes I would just get overwhelmed with anxiety, but I don't know what is specifically making me crazy. I remember one time a therapist said, but what are you afraid of, Bob? And I remember just thinking, everything. I'm just, everywhere I look, I see potential threats, potential dangers. I live in a world full of people, and they're all thinking stuff, and I don't know what they're thinking, but I suspect it's about me, and I need to figure it out. So I go through life, I accuse people of things. I remember one time on a job, and I yelled at a guy, just because I thought he was thinking something. I quit a job once or twice because I thought they didn't like me. I project my internal craziness onto others, and then I believe it because I don't know about you guys, my ego is entrenched in being right. It is hell-bent. Even when the evidence is overwhelming that I'm wrong, I'll find little justifications and explanations that I'm not really wrong. Because my ego doesn't want to be wrong. It doesn't care if it kills me as long as after I'm dead everybody's going, yeah, but that Bob, I'll tell you, he was right. He was right. And that's a hideous, hideous thing to be in the bondage of. And I don't know it. And this third delusion, and there's three of them in the book, and the third one is what I kept taking me back out again because it would get me so miserable. The first one kept me from getting a foothold here because I wasn't quite like you. I still had the fantasy that somehow, someday I'll control and enjoy my drinking, or that maybe in time I will no longer be alcoholic if I really went to a whole bunch of meetings for a while. And then finally, I'm a victim of the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. And my God, I try. I try. I don't know that. I think maybe all of us, as a demographic, might be the. I don't know that there's another demographic on the planet that has ever tried harder to make themselves happy and satisfied as we have. How many of us go through life in acquisition mode, convinced if I had her, if I had that, if I had it, if I had whatever it is, and then we obtain it and the shine of it wears off almost instantly. The acquiring of it is exciting. The having it is disappointing. Continually. One of my sponsees, Mike, who's funnier than he's Mike's funny guy. Mike says, I was born disappointed. I thought, oh, yeah. And so no wonder I'm a depressive. No wonder I keep getting depressed because life always lets me down. And I'm tired of having these amazing things that I go after and I get them and that's not it either. And that's not it. A victim of this delusion that I could wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if I only manage well. The word decision comes from a Latin word, scissore, meaning to cut. It's the same root word as the word scissors or incision when a surgeon cuts into a patient. And really, I think, in my experience, if you've taken step one and step two in your innermost self, now I'm not talking about intellectually placating it or understanding it, but really getting it in your innermost self, I think you've just cut away all the alternatives. There's either a new manager that's not human, because I've tried everything human. I've tried the greatest of the great in psychiatry. I've tried some religion. I've tried all kinds of Eastern stuff, and the end result is here I am. And no human power. So there better be something. And maybe this thing that I'm afraid to believe in, maybe, what if these people in AA, what if they said was right? What if this God really loved me as is? What if this God really, that they're talking to, because they keep saying about how it's got their best interests at heart. What if that was true? What if the creator of the universe actually cared about a little bum, worthless, parasitic dirtbag like me? Is that possible? And Kris Kristofferson, one of my favorite songwriters, he wrote a song that was made popular by Janis Joplin, and there's a line in the song that says, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." And sometimes all my defenses, all my justifications, all my rationalizations, they just don't hold water anymore. You know, they're threadbare. I've worn them out. You know, there was a great doctor who wasn't an alcoholic, but he worked with Marty Mann and started the National Council of Alcoholism. His name was Dr. Jelinek, and he created this Jelinek chart. It was a standard in treatment when I was working as a counselor. They had the Jelinek chart. And the very bottom of the chart and the progression of the disease is it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. One of the last things that happen before you either die or come up the other side and start to get better is what Jelinek referred to as the collapse of the alibi system, where all your excuses, all your justifications, all your rationalizations, and all your defenses are broken, and none of them work anymore. And as Chamberlain used to say, you'll eventually, if without a surrender, you'll eventually get to a place where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And there you are. And I think we stand at the turning point. I think there comes a time for some of us that even though we may have been opposed to God, even if we might have been adamant and almost hostile atheists at one time, if this disease has its way with you, you eventually get to a place where if there isn't something like that God, I am screwed here. Because I've fought the fight, I've done the battle, and I've lost, and I can't see any chance of winning in this battle against whatever this sickness is that drives me. And that's really the essence of step one and step two. I am an alcoholic. I have a hopeless, hopeless condition of mind and body. The greatest mental defense against the first drink has no sustenance and no traction with me. I can't stop drinking when I start, and I can't stay stopped once I've been stopped. And I'm insane. And all the great psychiatrists, no human power, and all the psychiatrists, I've tried the medications. I've done everything I could do, and nothing has worked. No human power. And you guys say God could and would if he were sought. Sometimes it's you just roll the dice. Sometimes you got to that place where there's nothing left to lose. And a funny thing happens to guys like me. When I start acting as if God exists, he starts to materialize. But I discovered that they're breaking through the God resistance barrier that a lot of us have. You know, we're God resistance, and you know, for multiple reasons. One is our fear of God and not being good enough. But another reason that most of us don't want to admit. But I don't like God for one basic reason, because if there is a God, he's cut my job for God's sakes. I don't like authority unless it's me, right? If somebody should be God, hey, should be me. And so I'm God resistant. When I finally am crushed and break through the God resistance, and I come to believe, and yet there's a long way to go between coming to believe and having a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. And I make this desperate decision. And I discovered, to my dismay, that the decision was shallow, the decision was unfulfilled, and I couldn't seem to carry it out. You know, at the very end of the section on the third step, when it's started transitioning into the fourth step, it talks about my experience. It says, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking me. Blocking me from what? From carrying out the decision in step three. Blocking me from the thing that Chamberlain talks about and a lot of the old timers about, between the God within. Blocking me from other people. After you're sober for a while, you may find yourself in an uncomfortable state of anxious apartness, where you go to meetings and once again it's that old squirmy feeling of it's all of them and then there's me. And I can't break through. I'm blocked from the decision in step three. I'm blocked from God and I'm blocked from you. Alcoholism is a disease of isolation. Chamberlain used to say it, it was beautiful. He said there was one problem that contained all problems, and that was conscious and unconscious separation. And our book says that the center or the root of that is selfishness and self-centeredness. See, I can't carry out the decision in step three because I got too much of me between me and you. Even though I've sat with guys and we are on our knees, I've been with guys on our knees and we said the third step prayer and oh, they're sobbing, they're having such an experience. Oh my God, it's like a spiritual experience. And then a week later, they get fired for punching their boss, you know, or some crazy thing like that. It really has little permanent effect. And William James talked about how the transitory experiences of the newly transformed people who have the epiphanies, the spiritual awakenings, and how those experiences just fade in time. And so I took the third step and continued to suffer from alcoholism, even though truly my decision was genuine. My decision had full intention. And I remember I started, right after I took the third step prayer, I did my first four step, which was not out of the book. It was just the confession, you know, the 40 pages of all my deep, dark secrets, you know, that kind of thing. And it didn't change me. And I'm suffering from alcoholism. I get down on my knees every single morning. I did this for, I still do it occasionally, not every morning, but I did it every morning for probably 20-some years. And I would say the third step prayer, among other prayers. And I would say that third step prayer and with full intention. I want to be that guy. I want God. I want to make my life none of my business, as it says in the prayer, where we made a decision. You know, we say to God, I offer myself to you for you to build with me and do with me as you will. I'm out of the loop here. It's none of my business, God. It's your business here. Here I am. And I can't do that very well, so relieve me of this bondage of self so I have a shot at even getting close to that kind of self-abandonment and to do it all for one reason, one reason only, so that victory over this bondage of self and all its aspects could bear witness to those I might help, which means I'm going to have to help some people. So it's really a contract of self-abandonment and service. It's designed for me to forget myself and devote my life to helping God's kids. Well, I get that. I understand that intellectually, and I get down on my knees and I say the third step prayer. And I get off my knees and I start worrying myself back into the throne, back into being in charge. And it's just one little thing. And you know how your head talks to you? Do you ever say the third step prayer and you really feel spiritual and you're driving to work having conversations in the car with people that aren't in the car? That is not a good sign. Because I'm playing God. And I don't know it sometimes. And so I wasn't until I started to dismantle this ego, this judgment machine that is the ego when I finally did my first fourth step out of the book. And, you know, we grow closer to God by our willingness to be wrong. My friend Ralph says, you want to grow God, shrink you. And this is a program of self-forgetting, of self-diminishment. And as I get smaller, God gets bigger. Because the problem all along is there's too much of me in the way. All my pomp, my ego, all the calamity as I worry myself into craziness in my head, and it clamors at me, just chatters at me all the time. And all the things that I obsessively turn to. I worry myself into insanity. I yearn and chase myself into insanity. And so when I started this, when I started doing the fifth step, this inventory I took at 4 years sober, it really shrunk me down. Now, not once and for all. This is a chronic illness. But as I started to go through every judgment in my life, whether it was in the resentment section or the fears or my perceptions of the sex relationships, and I started to see how wrong I had been about these people. When I looked at my mother and father from their side of the street and put myself in their shoes and looked at it through their eyes and the fears that they must have experienced and the frustrations, it was like, oh my God. How could I have been that wrong about my mother and father? How could I have been that wrong about my sister and my ex-girlfriends and the bosses and the police? And when I looked at it from your eyes, I saw what you saw. I was asleep in the daydream of my own life. I couldn't even see me the way you saw me. That's why I feel at such odds with the world, because it seems like at times everybody was against me. No, they weren't against me. They saw me the way I really was. And I couldn't digest it because I was so defended. When I started to dismantle the judgment machine of the ego, I started to get smaller, and I started realizing how wrong I'd been. And I was wrong about a lot. And I still am wrong about a lot from time to time. One of the things that, that's a whole talk, and I don't even want to get down that street. So as I got smaller, God gets bigger. And I think the center piece of my life, the reason I do all the rest of the steps, is simply to facilitate the decision in step three. I think that's the purpose of all of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that I can live a life that is none of my business, a life of self-abandonment and service. Chamberlain would say it over and over and over again, and it took me a while to get it, when he would say, your life's none of your business, it's God's business. All you have to concern yourself with is helping God's kids, and while you've got your hands off your own life, God will take care of you. And that has been true for me. As a matter of fact, what Dr. Paul used to say is proven to be true. And Paul used to say, sometimes when I'm helping people, I forget about my problems, and then when I come back to them, I realize they died of neglect. Maybe they never existed to begin with. Maybe they're the musterings of an ego that needs to scare me and give me problems to control me. Maybe they never existed. Maybe my life is divine order. I just don't know it. Maybe every problem that actually came into reality in my life, if you sent a CSI team there, you would only find my DNA, because my fear drove me to monkey it into reality, as what the psychologists call self-fulfilling prophecies. Maybe my life is perfect. Maybe I never left the Garden of Eden. I just don't know it. I had a friend, and I'll say this and then I'll end. I had a friend who was a pilot, and he used to say, he was the first guy I ever heard explain that AA could be altered attitudes, and an attitude was something that pilots talked about. It was the angle of approach. And then I had a bad attitude, but it wasn't that I was bad. It was my angle of approach was fear-driven and selfish. No wonder I was crashing my plane all the time. And he said he told a story one time that he was in a small plane and he was up at a higher altitude than normally he would go in this small single-engine plane. And he said he hit a wind shear or something like that, which I'm not a pilot, so I can get this wrong. But evidently this thing, these opposing wind currents of air threw him out of control into what is referred to as a tailspin. He said it was the most frightening thing you'd ever seen. It was horrible. He said every instinct in him was to pull back on all that stuff, to pull that nose up. But he had learned that this particular plane was made by its creator in such a way that if you did that, you'd crash the plane and die. What you had to do is something that was so against your emotions, you had to, instead of pulling it back, you had to push it forward and then let it go, and it will snap back on itself, and then the plane corrects itself and stabilizes. And maybe my life is like that. Maybe all these seeming problems, if I can just take my hands off of them, and I can go over here and I can try to help somebody and be of service and help with the chairs and go pick that new guy up or return my sponsee's phone call, and I know I don't want to return it because it's going to be 12 minutes about her until I want to hang myself. But if I just act like someone who is serious about the decision in step 3, and I act like someone who trusts that God's got his back and this is all going to work out even though I can't see how, if I show up like that, what I'll discover is that my life really is self-correcting, that my problems never really did exist, that my troubles are of my own making. They arise out of myself, and that's because I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so. So just to the extent over the last 41 years that I've practiced this trusting God and practiced this self-abandonment and practiced keeping my hands off my life and staying out of the driver's seat, and I'm not the director, I'm just a participant in the play. I don't even have a speaking part most of the time. I just pause when agitated. I restraint of tongue and pen. I nod a lot. I try to smile. And if I'm asked to participate, I'll try to participate in the role that he assigns. And that is the role of a servant. How can I help? And just to the extent that I live this life of self-abandonment and service, is my life rich? And it's full. And it has purpose. And there is nothing more important than a purposeful life. I get up every morning with purpose. I know why I'm alive. I know who I am today. My name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have a God that cares about me. And if I can trust him, he will keep me in good stead. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Bob.